Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
How you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing fine, Justin. How are you?
I'm doing great. Patreon actually got rid of their fees, right?
They were going to move the fees from us to the patrons, much to the dismay of us and other podcasters. I know I saw quite a number of posts from Lainey from True Crime Fan Club and from Dina with Twisted Philly. And we were all just like, what the hell? You know, we'll happily take the fee on. We don't need our patrons paying this. It's sort of like a tax on your goodwill. Luckily, the words reached the ears of the Patreon people and they changed their mind. I don't know what's going to come down the road. So we'll just keep an eye on it.
Yep. So nothing's changed. Everything's back to the way it was. We will happily take the hit to pay fees when people donate money to us. We're putting out new content on the peripheral and on Gen Y.
And this episode that we're doing here, probably going to be, I mean, I would say it's going to be the last episode of the year, don't you think, Justin?
Yeah, yeah. So you guys will have to chill, listen to the Patreon stuff for the next couple weeks.
Or older episodes in our catalog.
Absolutely. If there's ever an episode that you skipped, go back and check it out and see if there's something there. And if you go out to our Gen Y Pod shop, you can find all of our old archives out there. They are absolutely free. You just have to go download them, and because we run out of space on our feed. So sometimes you have to archive old stuff.
Also, you might want to keep an eye on our Facebook or our Instagram because, well, there will be updates coming soon regarding meetups in 2018. I know we mentioned early on with our Patreon that we wanted to do more meetups. We want to meet all of you. So keep an eye out. We might be coming to your town. We're looking at Los Angeles right now and St. Paul, Minnesota. Who knows? We might be adding in another one.
And we might be selling CDs because, well, net neutrality got repealed. Hey, you know, get the content from us any way you can. Tonight's case is a mysterious death or murder mystery. It is a wild ride. What are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
We're talking about a woman named Stacy Castor, who lost two husbands to early deaths and whose 20-year-old daughter almost died as well.
This happened in New York, 2005, the village of Weedsport. Stacy Castor met Michael Wallace in 1985. They were married after 5 years at Stacy's parents' house. She said that she was in love at first sight and wanted to marry this man within minutes of meeting him. Michael did have drinking problems, though, and he used drugs on occasion. He liked to party with his friends, didn't really settle down to a home life until after the birth of their daughter, Ashley. Stacy seemed very happy with her husband. Ashley was born in 1987. Their second daughter, Bree, was born a few years later in 1991. Ashley and Stacy were much closer while Bree was Michael's little princess, daddy's little girl. The lack of close bond between Ashley and Michael was said to be apparent. But it's one of those things where we all remember our childhoods differently. So after 10 years of marriage, things started to get a little rocky for them, for Stacy and Michael. They weren't getting along like they used to. He never really got out of his drinking phase, and there were actual some claims that he was unfaithful, but they were totally unsubstantiated. But whatever the case, they're just not getting along very well. In November, December 1999, Michael starts getting sick. He's behaving as if he's drunk. He's feeling faint, nauseated. Stacy says, "Well, yeah, quit drinking and you won't feel that way." I'm not sure the family's taking this as seriously as they should. Michael is asked to visit his doctor. His symptoms include nausea, coughing, headaches. He appears swollen and puffy, but within a few weeks and no visit to the doctor, Michael will be found dead at home.
At the time, Michael was at home with his daughter, Ashley, who said her father was on the couch and had been making strange faces. And she remembers him lifting his arm up in the air at one point and then bringing it back down to his side before it just sort of slid off. So it's very strange.
It's almost as if he was trying to get her attention, but then thought better of it and just fell asleep. Maybe he was trying to get her attention, but just became too weak. Ashley has to get her sister Bree from school, so she's running late. She just takes off. She doesn't know there's anything wrong. When she returns home later, her mother and grandmother have kind of rerouted the kids over to the neighbor's house, where they're informed that their father has passed away. Now, he was taken to the hospital and they tried to revive him, but he's pretty much dead on arrival. The doctors and EMTs believe that he has died of a heart attack.
At that time, Michael was 38 years old.
That's really young for a heart attack. I know that people don't eat as well these days, but still, 38, I'm 41, so that's really young.
And typically what happens when someone dies unexpectedly, an autopsy would be performed just to see what they actually died of. Not a guess. We want to know why a relatively young man died. When Stacy is asked if she would like to have Michael autopsied, she says it's not necessary. The doctors are saying he died from heart trouble.
I actually spoke with a surgeon and asked, do they not perform autopsies on every death? And he said, hell no. They only do it on suspicious deaths or where there is a question. So I said, if someone dies from liver failure or heart disease, do they do an autopsy? And he said, no, it's pretty much up to the family and it's not a thing every time.
I recall speaking with author Ron Francell, who co-authored the book Morgue, A Life and Death with famed pathologist Vincent DiMaio. And he had told me that medical examiners who perform autopsies are not very common, very much overworked, and just cannot investigate every death. Michael's mother was there at the hospital, and she didn't have an issue with no autopsy being performed. But Michael's sister, Rosemary, did want his death investigated because when she took a look at him, she noticed his upper body looked very purple. But since it's being signed off on by Michael Wallace's wife and his mother, the matter ends there. Again, I would think that an autopsy was called for since he was relatively young and had been mysteriously sick prior to his death. I mean, his symptoms were similar to drunkenness, but he maintained that he wasn't drunk during that time.
It's kind of mysterious, but they all agree he had health issues and that something must have caused a heart attack. According to Stacy, the physician was the one who told her it was a heart attack,
and an autopsy wasn't necessary. So with Michael Wallace's passing, it's just the mother and her two daughters. Stacy will collect a $50,000 life insurance policy, which she will use to bury her husband and get back on her feet. The daughters are, I guess, left to their own devices a lot. And Ashley is put in charge of watching her sister, Bree, built-in babysitter. But for the most part, they don't mind not having a father in their life.
Well, it might also be the case that they're doing okay, even if their father is missed.
Stacy will go on to get a tattoo on her shoulder. It's a teddy bear with angel wings sitting on a cloud. So this is her memory, her memorial to him. Ashley was around 11 years old at the time, and Bree was 2 or 3 years younger. Now, 3 years later, their mom will start dating one of her bosses named David Castor.
Yeah, David Castor had recently divorced. He had one son, David Castor Jr., and they enjoyed spending time together. David was a boss at a heating and cooling business, and Stacy worked there as an office manager.
They worked on cars together. They were really into, I guess, motorcycles, ATVs, jet skis. His arrival into the family wasn't exactly welcome. Bree and Ashley didn't know what to think of him. And he actually told Bree and Ashley that he already had a son and he didn't need any more children in his life. David works, but he seems to be spending all his money on his toys, his car, and his projects, which, yeah, that doesn't go over well.
See, this is something that worked when he was single again. He could go and buy that motorcycle that he wanted or the car to restore. Now that he's married, now he needed to speak with his wife about it so there isn't this friction. Not the kind of situation they had planned when they first got married. Reading about how both these families' lives were before Stacy and David began dating and then got married, it struck me how both these families seemed to be doing pretty well then. David was close to his son, working on cars, and Stacy and her daughter seemed to be doing just fine. These two families coming together, as sometimes happens, isn't exactly smooth.
I don't want to get into giving relationship advice, but if you don't want kids, maybe don't marry somebody with kids. I don't know. That's just off the cuff for me. But when Ashley graduates high school, she actually gets the endorsement from her stepfather that she probably always wanted. David seemed very happy for her, and things seemed to take on a new tone in the household.
But in 2005, they had planned to celebrate their anniversary by going to an amusement park together. Since Bree wasn't an adult, Stacy didn't want to leave her at home. I think she was 15 years old. Well, Stacy wanted to bring her with them and told David as much, and he didn't like this idea at all.
Yeah, you don't tell a mother that she can't bring her child. That never goes over very well. It becomes sort of a knockdown, drag-out fight.
This marriage already got off on the wrong foot in the beginning when David said he didn't need more kids, and Stacy was aware of that. Now he's saying Bree can't come on their anniversary weekend, and she's her daughter, so this just isn't going to work.
They're arguing, having this fight. They're in the bedroom, and according to Stacy, he says, "Get away from me." So she backs out, closes the door, and leaves. The next day, Stacy goes to work, and being that she works with her husband and that they just had this fight, she finds it odd that he doesn't show up to work. So later on, she will call the house to check on him, but he won't answer. And around 2 p.m. in the afternoon, she calls in a welfare check on him because he's not answering or coming out of the house.
Even though they're fighting, she is now concerned. She needs some intervention because he isn't talking to her. He's not responding to her. He's been in there a while, and she can't do this on her own. Sergeant Robert Willoughby arrives. Stacy expresses concern for her husband, says he's been depressed lately, and that he keeps a gun in their room. When the sergeant approaches the door, he can hear a TV or a radio on, but David does not respond to him from beyond the door.
The sergeant breaks through the locked door, and he finds David face down, naked on the bed, and there's vomit.
There are various bottles, a cranberry juice bottle, an apricot brandy bottle, and a bottle of antifreeze. Something terrible happened here.
There's also a glass of green liquid, pretty much is the antifreeze.
And an unused glass there as well.
So they're looking at all these items and they're thinking about how Stacy has said that he was depressed and he apparently was drinking antifreeze mixed with alcohol to cover the bitter flavor or something to that effect. It was easier to drink for him to kill himself.
Antifreeze can be sweet, so some companies add an agent to make it bitter to discourage animals and kids from drinking it in case they encounter it. It can be very deadly.
I can't imagine, even if it's sweet, tasting very good. It's just not a pleasant thing.
There's an idea here that David Castor was depressed. He had had a motorcycle accident a few years before, and it was said that his work and his home life seemed to go downhill a bit since then. So perhaps this is just a culmination of personal and business troubles. You wonder if the accident did cause something significant to happen to his mood or his demeanor.
If you remember, he was really into cars and motorcycles, all these different things that require antifreeze. So it's not uncommon for him to have it in his garage. This is very impactful to the family. They think it's out of the blue and it's really hard on them. But even if they didn't get along, it's still family and they still very much cared about him.
Ashley even said it bothered her quite a bit because she had lost her father when he was just 38 years old. And now her stepfather has died at 48. Still pretty young to die like this. So now her mother has lost two husbands unexpectedly, and she felt bad for her mom too.
Ashley even confided in a friend in a letter she wrote. She said that she was depressed and had considered suicide.
You wonder what has gone on in this house that has caused a man to seemingly take his own life, and then for the daughter to express that she has thought of killing herself.
While the police are at the house, the investigators are searching around and they find in the trash can in the kitchen a turkey baster with small green droplets in it.
It was odd. The baster seemed to be pretty new, except that it had recently been used.
There didn't seem to be any meals prepared that day that required a turkey baster. I personally don't sit around using a turkey baster to slurp up soup or drink anything with, so it's odd that this would be thrown away at that time.
What appears to be in the baster is antifreeze, so I'm not sure who cooks with that. This is obviously connected to what happened in the bedroom, but how did it end up in the trash if David used it?
Yeah, why would you need to use a turkey baster to get antifreeze out of a bottle when you can just pour it out?
This is just not making sense now, and you don't have to be a 25-year veteran of the police force for this to start looking like a homicide rather than a suicide.
They collect the glasses and the bottles for testing. They end up finding Stacy's fingerprints on all of these items. They also find David's DNA on the tip of the turkey baster. If he was the last one to handle these items, why are only Stacy's fingerprints found on them and not his? It seems a little weird.
Stacy did admit to bringing him cranberry juice, so her prints should be found on that bottle. And I know that the antifreeze bottle had a palm print on it, but they couldn't identify it, and they believe it's not Stacy's.
Yeah. So the medical examiners will check into David's death. They'll find that he died from ethylene glycol poisoning. Investigators get a judge to sign off on some wiretaps for the phones that Stacy uses. They do this because they don't really buy into the suicide angle. And they set up surveillance at the Castor home and the cemetery where both of her former husbands have been buried and where the plot is waiting for her between the two men. Now, Stacy, in remembrance of her second husband, gets another teddy bear tattoo with angel wings on her other shoulder. So she has two tattoos now and two gravestones for her dead husbands. At this time, Ashley is graduated from high school and is preparing for college. Bria is still in high school. The family is seriously divided since the death of David. There are questions there. Stacy has David's will, and it reveals that she pretty much gets everything, leaving nothing to David Castor Jr., David's son.
and he and his father were close. For him not to get anything, really, just doesn't make sense. The police are very suspicious of Stacy. What did the surveillance and wiretaps reveal, Justin?
The wiretaps didn't reveal much because she never discussed what happened to David on the phone, but there are still suspicions because of what they found at the house. The phone records did reveal something, though. When she was asked about the day that David died, she had claimed that she had called him numerous times to check on him. But the call records show that she only called once, just before calling for help. There were also no calls the prior 3 days to David Castor's phone before this single call from Stacy. Also, she never visited David's grave or either of her husband's graves. Investigators are moving on her now. They bring her in for questioning under the guise of finishing up paperwork and getting some statements from her when they interrogate her.
They start to ask her questions that she doesn't want to answer. Now, we say it all the time, don't just sit down with police in an effort to clear things up. You aren't qualified. Since she doesn't like where the line of questioning is headed, she stops answering questions and wants to speak with an attorney.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
In early September 2007, her daughter gets pulled out of her first day of college to speak with detectives.
They tell her that both her dad and her stepfather were murdered. They were poisoned.
So this freaks Ashley out, and she calls her mom about it. And this keys off Stacy. She tells her daughter that she should come home, and when she gets to the house, her mom says they need to celebrate, and she offers her alcohol.
Yeah, I believe the way she put it was, "We've been through a lot, let's get drunk."
They start to drink, but Ashley thinks the alcohol tastes weird. Her mom keeps telling her it's fine, you just got to keep drinking it, but it doesn't really go anywhere. Ashley goes to bed, and the next day, her mom starts the day off with, "Hey, let's drink some more." Ashley says that it's not even noon yet, you know, drinking before noon. Her mom says that by the time they get their supplies and start drinking, it will be afternoon. They start drinking, and Ashley again complains that it doesn't taste good. Her mother gives her the advice to place the straw at the back of her throat and start drinking and count to 10. So she won't taste it as much. It's about getting intoxicated. It's not about flavor, really. I don't think it's that out of the ordinary for a college kid to drink this.
I agree. I don't think it's that odd either. And if you think about what's been going on with the family, her dad died young, her stepdad passed away pretty young as well. And with all of these difficulties that they've been going through, her mother has been there all along for her. So why not trust her?
I mean, college kids just want to get drunk. They'll drink garbage. So she's not really questioning her mom right now.
I mean, I don't know how familiar Ashley was with alcohol. I mean, we could assume that she was familiar enough since her mom would let her have a little something once in a while.
This is pretty much the last thing Ashley remembers. Stacy said that Ashley went to her room, closed the door, and didn't come back out. Bree is the one who discovers her sister and that there's something wrong with her. When she checks on her, she saw that her sister was on her bed with the pillows across her face. And next to her was a prescription bottle and an empty bottle of vodka.
Ashley would not wake up. So Bree called for her mom, who would call for help. On that call, Stacy said she suspected that her daughter had taken dozens of pills and drank a bottle of vodka.
They had lots of prescriptions at the house, including Ambien and other drugs. So not good.
Also in the bed is a letter. This letter is typewritten. It's very long and rambling. Bree found it and didn't look at it too long before she handed it to her mom. When help arrives, Ashley is rushed to the hospital. The emergency room doctor stated that her heart rate was over 170 and up to 190. She couldn't speak properly. She was incoherent.
A lot of the letter is just about, I love you, mom, and this isn't your fault. It was all me.
It has Ashley's name at the bottom of the letter and mommy at the top. According to the poorly typewritten contents of the letter, she was concerned that her mother was going to go to prison for something that she didn't do. So in the letter, Ashley describes how she poisoned both her dad and stepdad with antifreeze.
So it's a suicide letter. Nothing's handwritten, but she gives details only the killer would know. She will wake up in the hospital with a man basically yelling in her face. It's Detective Spinelli, who seems accusatory and angry, but she's waking up from this coma and she's confused. This detective wants to know about the note that they found.
I can see why the detective is so desperate to get information from Ashley, because they had suspected her mother of being the killer. But if Ashley is responsible, then they have been on the wrong track from the very start. This letter could completely alter their investigation.
I kind of have a problem here, though, because she just woke up and she's out of it. It's not exactly proper for them to question her. But on the flip side, if she's totally out of it, she's probably not going to lie very well either.
Yeah, well, the detective wants to know about what she took, what she drank, and about this letter. For Ashley, this is very frustrating because she said that she doesn't know what he's talking about. She denied writing any such letter or taking any drugs.
A suicide note is one of the most intimate kinds of letters a person can write. It's, I'm going to end my life, and admitting to multiple murders, but it's all typewritten out. That seems weird to me.
They aren't just letting Stacy in to see her daughter, and they can see that she's shaking and she's demanding to be let in, but they just won't let her go in. If she was behind the murders, then she's probably behind what happened to Ashley too.
So this whole time, Stacy's been out in the hallway. The detective believes Ashley and her denial of anything. So they go out into the hallway and they put Stacy in handcuffs and take her into custody. Now, recently, during their investigation, they had actually exhumed Michael Wallace's body without anyone's knowledge and had an autopsy done. This was the first autopsy ever performed on him, and they discovered clear evidence of ethylene glycol poisoning.
For those of you who listened to our James Cowan episode, we discussed ethylene glycol poisoning in it, and it's a miserable way to die. It breaks down in the body into glycolic and oxalate acids. Oxalate crystals form and end up in the brain, kidneys, lungs, and heart of the person who was poisoned. The effect on a person in the first 72 hours can include nausea, vomiting, seizures, breathing difficulties, pain, and kidney failure, as well as death. It can take just a few ounces of it to kill.
To put that in perspective, a 12-ounce can of Coke, if you took a big gulp of that, it would be enough to possibly kill you.
Not everyone is comfortable with exhuming a relative, but in this case, they really wanted to figure out whether Stacy's first husband was murdered as well. As we said, the autopsy revealed that he was in fact poisoned with ethylene glycol.
So they have her in custody. They're questioning her. So they charge her and take her to trial. It takes place January 2009, just a couple years later. We know that both Michael Wallace and David Castor have died from ethylene glycol poisoning, but Ashley Wallace nearly died as well. Samples of her blood were taken, and Dr. Carla Walker from St. Paul, Minnesota, testified that she found more than a half dozen drugs in her system. These included substances for ADHD, antidepressants, as well as antihistamines, sleeping pills, over-the-counter pain meds. Some of these substances were at very high levels, but if you take any one of these, it could be fatal.
The prosecution has a lot of evidence on their side implicating Stacy Castor in the murder of her husband, David, in the attempted murder of her daughter, Ashley, and the forgery of David Castor's will, not to mention the poisoning death of her first husband, who they suspect was killed by Stacy as well. Speaking of the will, David's lawyer testified that the original will left everything to David's first wife or her children if she passed away.
So they call their first witness to the stand, and they call Ashley. She was there to testify against her mother, but the defense is going to use her as their motive or their other suspect here. They have a pretty good theory going. Ashley has a detailed suicide letter where she admits to the murders and has written a letter to a boyfriend where she had expressed being depressed and considering suicide.
The defense also pointed out that Ashley had troubled relationships with both her father and her stepfather, which could be part of her motive for these murders.
And Ashley was the last person to see her father before he died and was home when her stepfather died. So they establish motive and opportunity here against Ashley, at least the defense does. The only problem is that prosecutors have covered their bases. The DNA from the turkey baster is only on the tip. That seems very intentional. It was used to deliver the antifreeze that they found in the glass to David Castor. They also know from their interview with Stacy Castor that she misstates antifreeze as anti-free, the same way she said it in the suicide letter, which is weird. They play the police interrogation for the jury. She makes mention that her husband probably died from drinking antifreeze because there was a show about a wife who kills her husband that way.
It's not just the use of the word antifreeze that puts Stacy Castor in a bad position. It's also that they find on her computer that the suicide letter, as well as practice letters, were written under her profile at times when Ashley was at school. So the defense will want to argue that anybody could go and work under that profile on the computer. But the problem here is that everything is timestamped. So they can look at those timestamps and look at when Ashley was confirmed to be at school. And now they know, well, it wasn't Ashley that typed it up. And yet the letter is stating that it's from Ashley. So there's no way for Ashley to have typed up these letters.
So we have timestamps on the file that prove they were written at times Ashley wasn't home. The fact that David and Ashley's fingerprints are not found on any of these items. Stacy's antifreeze word is on both the letter and she says it in the interrogation. The prosecutors also point out that using antifreeze to in someone's life makes little sense as David owned a shotgun and it was right under his bed.
Michael Wallace, David Caster, and Ashley Wallace were all poisoned. Stacy Caster, never poisoned. Stacy did take the stand in her own defense and kind of held her own, I guess, but basically only because she wouldn't give in to the prosecutors and admit to anything.
The prosecutors, if you watch the video of this, he's yelling at Stacy. He's yelling his questions, and half of them aren't even questions. He's just yelling and accusing her of stuff. And she just sits there calmly and says, "Nope, it wasn't me." Pretty cold. Also during the trial, they will pull up the will for David and they find that it's signed over to Stacy, but it's all in her handwriting. She has a friend that signed as a witness, but her friend claims that she had thought it was just a legal document and wasn't a will.
Yeah, there was a married couple, Paul and Lynn Pulaski, who had supposedly witnessed David Caster signing this will. They signed on as witnesses. In 2005, they signed affidavits to say that they had witnessed David signing this will in 2003. But now they were trying to say that they had no idea that it was a forged will that they were signing, and that they signed as witnesses after David Caster's death in 2005.
I can see them trying to help as if, you know, because there's no suspicion of murder back then. So maybe they were just trying to help their friend, but that was before they understood the magnitude of the situation. You know, she's a single mom and the will signed over to her, then she gets to take care of her family. But Stacy, under oath, admits to forging the will. She says she does this for her family and that she had to do it.
David Caster Jr. had tried to contest the will, but since Lynn and Paul signed affidavits, he dropped this quest. But when they changed their story, he would again attempt to contest the will and to get the money.
Now they call Bree to the stand to testify. And when she talks about finding Ashley in her room, she says that her mother didn't call 911 right away. She says that Stacy looked around a bit and seemed to be stalling. She said that her mother didn't seem too worried about getting any immediate help for Ashley.
The defense built their case around Ashley being the culprit. The prosecution built theirs around Stacy being a murderer. The jury later spoke about the trial, and they believed Ashley, not Stacy.
When her father, Michael, died, Ashley was 11 years old, and he was poisoned with antifreeze. I'm not sure she would really be able to come up with a plot to kill him using antifreeze over a period of time.
Right, this seems too sophisticated a crime for a child to come up with. I can see them picking up a knife or even a gun, but this idea that an 11-year-old Ashley poisoned her dad just doesn't make sense.
I can buy kids stabbing somebody, bludgeoning them to death. To poison someone for weeks isn't something that I think is in a kid's capabilities.
On February 5th, 2009, Stacy Caster was found guilty. What was she found guilty of, and what did they sentence her to on March 5th, 2009, Justin?
She was 25 years for the second-degree murder in the poisoning death of David Caster, 25 years for the second-degree attempted murder of her daughter, Ashley, and the forgery of the will prompted the judge to add an additional 1 to 4 years onto the rest of her sentence, and she was sent to the Bedford Hills Correctional Facility for Women.
So, guilty. Stacy Caster will need to serve at least 51 years or so before she could become eligible for parole.
Essentially a life sentence, yeah.
She would be in her late 80s. Just so the listeners understand just how terrible her crimes were, let's go over what the evidence and the testimony revealed about the deaths of her husbands and the attempted murder of her daughter, Ashley. I'll start with Michael Wallace, Stacy's first husband. According to the autopsy results, Michael had ethylene glycol in his brain and liver and rat poison in his liver. It is believed that he wasn't dying fast enough for Stacy, and she finished him off with rat poison.
That's cold. David Caster, her second husband, was poisoned by Stacy over a 4-day period. While he was supposedly locked in his bedroom, Stacy used a turkey baster to feed David antifreeze when he was too weak to do anything for himself. Ashley, her daughter, was drugged by her mother with sleeping pills and then spoon-fed vodka and prescriptions over a period of 17 hours.
David Kastor Jr. spoke at the sentencing. He said, "Your Honor, she is a monster and a threat to society. She has created so much pain and death with this, creating multiples of pain and death with this in the families of those she hurt."
I think the sentence is just. Even after all of this, Stacy has maintained her innocence. Her defense attorney said that he would appeal. I find that it's very obvious from the physical evidence that she's responsible for these crimes. She had the knowledge and the opportunity for both.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, passes the savings on to you, and Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices. Along with premium fabrics and finishes, how can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
The defense had some major issues with the trial. We know that they didn't like the prosecutor yelling at their client. I mean, at one point, her lawyer even asked for a mistrial because of this. Is that badgering the witness, Justin?
A little bit, but, you know, I think it works.
I think sometimes what happens is, you know, just like you have your armchair detectives at home, they get really angry with somebody that they're reading up on. I think some of these prosecutors feel the same way.
Yeah.
They felt that including details about the death of Stacy's first husband wasn't fair to her. I mean, I get that. I get why her lawyers would have a problem with that. After all, she wasn't charged with his death. This was basically, she killed before and got away with it. Are you going to let her off now? In the end, though, I think it's fair to say that no lawyer could have saved her from the guilty verdicts.
Yeah. I think her defense attorney actually did a wonderful job, as best as he could. Maybe wonderful is the wrong word choice, but as much as I found what he did was despicable, he did the best to paint a different theory to protect his client, Stacy. I don't understand how some of Stacy's family still supports her to this day. So there's a big divide in the family, and her mother still believes in her daughter, Stacy.
Yeah, her mother and her stepfather and some other relatives on her side of the family all believe her and believe that Ashley murdered her father's and tried to take her own life. After the death of David Kastor, Stacy got another boyfriend.
Huh.
And he even attempted to help her. While she was being held by the authorities, he called to tell her that he found a prescription bottle hidden in the closet. She said, "No matter what you do, don't give that to anyone." This call was recorded.
I wonder if it had her fingerprints or DNA. You know, I'm sure it tied in somehow.
I guess what I find most surprising was that he wanted to date her. Does he not know who she is? I mean, she's a black widow, right? In late 2007, Ashley Wallace had gotten into trouble with Stacy's new boyfriend, Michael. She had some belongings that were left at her mother's house, and she got into an argument with him about it. She told him to watch his back. Well, this guy felt threatened and he reported it to the police. Ashley and her boyfriend's dad, Mark Gandino, visited her mom's house, and Gandino threatened Michael by telling him, "You're going to be dead. I know where you live." So Michael is dating a murderer and is getting death threats from her family and her daughter's boyfriend, her daughter's boyfriend's dad.
I don't feel much sympathy.
Is this really a situation he wants to be in?
I would just assume he wouldn't want to be involved with this circus, but people like drama. On June 11th, 2016, Stacy Kastor is found dead at the Bedford Hills Correctional Facility for Women. There was a lot of hoopla about this being a murder or something suspicious, but an autopsy revealed that she died from a heart attack. I take a little bit of issue that they bothered with an autopsy when they didn't do it before and they spent taxpayers' money on this, but whatever. With her death, David Castor's son, David Jr., gets a motion approved by a judge to move his father away from his killer. Because remember back at the cemetery, they had them all lined up with tombstones and plots next to each other, and his son doesn't really want him there. Some of the friends said, what is she doing? Starting a collection? And you think about her tattoos, which really are terrible. The bears and the clouds, it's just really poor quality. If you do get a memorial tattoo of somebody, a loved one, you might want to spend a little bit more money on it. So the fact that her dead husbands are buried near her and Stacy's plot would be in between them.
David Castor Jr. didn't just get to move his father's body, but he also got the right to destroy his tombstone. It had Stacy's name on it as she was his wife. You can imagine just how much of a relief that must have been to wreck that tombstone. Someone has described these burial plots that Stacy has as a monument to murder. And what's really frightening is I had read that not only was David Castor and Michael Wallace buried there, but also her father, Jerry Daniels. I don't think I'm going out on a limb here, but if Ashley Wallace had died, I wonder where she would have ended up. In 2010, District Attorney Bill Fitzpatrick, who had battled her at trial, announced that he was investigating the death of Jerry Daniels, who was Stacy's father. He had been in the hospital with a lung issue, and before he was to be released, Stacy visited him, and everyone saw her there with an open soda can. The next day, he was dead. A bit unexpected. No autopsy can be performed as Stacy had her father's remains cremated. A coincidence that a man in Stacy's life suddenly dies? Was she possibly a serial killer? We'll never know. The suspicion is there, but with no body and no testing to be done, we just cannot say for certain. But I don't have any doubt that once you consider the two murders, as well as the attempted murder of her daughter, that Stacy Castor would have been a serial killer if she didn't end up as one prior to her death.
The last time I checked, the definition of a serial killer was two or more victims with a cooling down period. This definition changes. Sometimes it's three or more. But with two or more, I consider her a serial killer.
Yeah, I don't have any problem with anyone labeling her a serial killer. You can just take Jerry Daniels out of the picture, and you still have the attempted murder of her daughter, Ashley. This attempted murder really, really was hard on this family because Ashley and Bree, they stuck together, which is great, but they lost their mother. They lost their mother because of the murder she committed. She almost took her daughter's life, and then she ended up dying in prison. They say family is everything, but in this case, I'm not sure that Stacy Castor is family. She's a monster.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity, that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.